tyranny, the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us this morning some students and some Department of Justice externs. So of the students, we have Franklin High School. Would those students please rise? Thank you for coming. You're welcome. And you may be seated. We have Department of Justice externs. Would they please stand? We're delighted to welcome you all. Are you with the University of Wisconsin Law School? Raise your hands. Marquette? Mm-hmm. Other? Mm-hmm. We found out. Okay, thank you. You may be seated. The students are of the high school are here with us to participate in the Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. All the students across the state are invited to come. If the invitation is accepted, they're given materials about the case. They may do work on the case, and they come for oral argument. They will meet at noon with a justice of this court, and everyone is welcome to participate in that meeting. The meeting will deal with the procedure of the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. The Department of Justice externs will also meet. They will meet with, I think, what do we agree on? Me? At this group? Good. I'm free for lunch. All right. Now, then I suggest that the Department of Justice externs might want to return, if they can, for the meeting. So let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks. And it is with Justice Crooks, with whom you're going to meet this noon for the students who come back after our second argument. And ordinarily on the chair in the far right is Justice Diane Sykes, who could not be with us today. So, having done the introductory comments, we will now call 02-2433 CR State v. Kevin Harris. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman.
Thank you, and may it please the court. If this mic isn't in the right place, let me know. I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state, which is the appellant petitioner in this case. The state sought review of the Court of Appeals decision in this case, which is now published, primarily for three reasons. To ask this court to correct and overturn the Court of Appeals' erroneous holding on what the Constitution requires a prosecutor to disclose. To overturn the Court of Appeals' erroneous interpretation of the discovery statute regarding what the prosecutor is required to give in discovery, and to hold that the Due Process Clause does not guarantee a criminal defendant disclosure of material exculpatory or material impeachment evidence prior to entry of a guilty plea. First of all, we ask this court to overturn the Court of Appeals' holding that is at paragraph 36 of its decision, and the decision is in our appendix, it's page 115, in which the court said The state violates the Constitution if it withholds the type of information that could form the basis for further investigation by the defense, or in other words, what they call potentially exculpatory evidence. This is far broader than any holding of the United States Supreme Court or this court or previous decisions of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. The existing case law prior to the Court of Appeals decision made it very, very clear that the Constitution is only violated if the prosecutor fails to disclose evidence that is favorable to the defense, either going to guilt and innocence or punishment, and that is material. And it defines material as causing the court to lack confidence or undermine confidence in the outcome, and that is measured, as is ineffective assistance of counsel, by whether there's a reasonable probability that if the evidence had been disclosed, the result of the proceeding would have been different.
Now, you're more concerned, or not more concerned, but you're concerned about the broadness of the Court of Appeals constitutional issue. But in this case, I just want to ask, in the Harris, in this case before us, your last statement about the reasonable probability or looking at the evidence here, I'm talking about the withholding. There was a little, I don't know if there was a dispute, but as I gather, this so-called encounter with the grandfather, are you saying that you do not believe that that was material or substantial?
Yes, we are saying that also. But before we get to the question of this particular facts, we think this it's critical that this court correct the misstatements of law in the case. But yes, as to the facts of this case, it is definitely our position that the undisclosed information was not material in the constitutional sense, even if you would hold that the prosecutor has to disclose prior to a guilty plea, which is yet a separate question.
Right, well, what would the language be that you would use?
We would repeat the language of the United States Supreme Court's cases that hold that a prosecutor's failure to disclose favorable evidence does not violate due process unless the evidence is material to guilt or punishment. And evidence is material in this constitutional sense only if the nondisclosure undermines confidence in the outcome of the proceeding because there is a reasonable probability that if the evidence had been disclosed to the defense, the result of the proceeding would have been different. And the cases setting that forth are in our brief at page 7 primarily.
And that's the Strickland test, which is even harder to meet than the harmless error test.
I don't think it's harder to meet. It's the flip side. I mean, if there is harmless error, you would also have a reasonable probability of a different result and vice versa. I believe.
No, it just undermines the confidence. You don't have to necessarily say that the jury would go the other way. They might not.
But for the harmless error test, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that but for the that absent the error, the jury would have I have to get it straight because I've just reversed
That's right.
Who has to hold it.
It would have to be that you'd prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it did not contribute to the verdict.
Right. Beyond a reasonable doubt that
did not contribute to the verdict, not necessarily that the result would be different.
But the reasonable probability test isn't necessarily that the result would be different either. It's only a reasonable probability that the result would be different, not a preponderance or higher standard than that. And I can't think of the name of the case. I know there is a case, and I'm not sure if it's this court or the Court of Appeals, that says the two are equivalents. It just shifts the burden to, in ineffective assistance of counsel, of course, it's the burden is on the defendant, not the state.
Okay.
Counselor, I have my major concern is whether the plea was knowing and voluntary, so you know the context in which I asked this question. And when I look at the standard of materiality, what you're really looking at is a verdict that comes down after there's been a trial. It's not, the standard is more difficult to apply to a plea because we don't know why this person pled or didn't plead. That's not something that's, you know, what is in his mind when he accepts this plea is a little bit difficult to determine. So I guess I'm wondering, is the standard really the same when we're looking at a plea as what you put forth, which is the standard after a verdict, for materiality. And that's the question I'm looking at.
Yes. If we ask this Court to also get to, but if there is a right to disclosure of material exculpatory or impeachment evidence prior to a guilty plea at all, then according to Sturgeon, which follows lower court, Supreme Court cases, or federal court cases, we look, as we do at the ineffective assistance test in the withdrawal of a plea, at whether there's a reasonable probability the defendant would not have pled but would have insisted on going to trial. Excuse me. And that's measured, however, not just subjectively. It's not enough for the defendant to say, I would have, but objectively. And in turn, to get at that, you have to look at how important would that have been at trial, which, you know, is, you know, you don't have the full record in the guilty plea context usually. Well, I guess you almost never do. But so that makes it a little more difficult. But I think the bottom line is different, that we're looking at, if there's no reasonable probability it would have changed the result of trial, then there's no reasonable probability he would have insisted on going to trial rather than plead guilty. So the two are interconnected.
Yeah, they are. But what troubles me is not letting the defendant have the opportunity to have this information when there has been a discovery request. And I understand that you focus your discovery request on what's required on the statute, which is a different question than we're talking about here with the constitutional right to enter a plea knowing involuntarily. But what troubles me is not letting the defendant be able to make that choice, having the prosecutor decide what the defendant would have done if the defendant had the information, which he never got. Do you see the problem I'm having with it?
Well, if I understand you correctly, and correct me obviously if I don't, I think you're saying two different things. One, I just want to say it's not the prosecutor who's deciding what he would have done. It's ultimately the court on post-conviction motion.
I'm talking about the plea.
The plea.
Okay. You're letting the prosecutor decide initially, as initial matter, whether this information is material to the defendant's decision to make a plea.
And what we're saying is that due process doesn't require, as part of a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent plea, that the defendant know the evidence in that sense, either exculpatory or inculpatory. The defendant only needs to know the nature of the charges, the direct consequence that he understands, if you enter this plea, you will be convicted, just as if you'd gone to trial, you will be sentenced, and that he knows the nature of the plea includes the elements, and that he's not been coerced by, you know, undue pressure or false promises, but he doesn't have to know the evidence. And one reason that we know that our argument is that we know that you don't have to disclose exculpatory is that the Constitution doesn't require the state to disclose inculpatory evidence either. So apart from discovery rules, when we're talking the Constitution itself, and really, if you're going to say the defendant should be the one who has the full access to information so he can make the most informed and best decision as to which way to go, or the one he thinks will be most advantageous, logically, he would have to have access to both to do that. Only knowing a piece of exculpatory evidence and not knowing what the state has for inculpatory evidence isn't going to make him any more able to make that plea. And we don't think that the Constitution guarantees that. Brady is a trial right that's designed to ensure that innocent people are not wrongfully convicted because the prosecutor withheld information, you know, exculpatory material evidence. It's not a pretrial or a guilty plea right.
So your position is that any time the defendant pleads guilty, you don't have to give him anything because there's a guilty plea. He doesn't have to know ahead of time, and he doesn't have to know after the guilty plea because there's no trial.
Right. The Constitution doesn't require it. There may be other discovery rights, but that's separate, depending on when he pleads.
All right.
Wellman, I'm having a lot of trouble with what Ruiz really stands for. And the reason I'm having that trouble is it's such a different procedural setup than what we have in this case or what we had in Sturgeon. And yet I know the position you've taken is that Ruiz, in effect, overrules Sturgeon.
Can you tell me why you're so strong in that position, why you think that's the correct position?
Well, we take that position because the Supreme Court itself used very, very broad language in issuing its opinion in Ruiz. It didn't, frankly, when Ruiz was pending and being argued, I would have, if I had guessed, and I would have been wrong, I would have thought the court might just say, well, we don't have to decide if there is a constitutional right, because if there is, you can waive it. And decided on that. They didn't. They went to the merits, which is what both parties and all the amici had argued. But they did it in very broad language. For example, they phrased the question as whether the Fifth and Sixth Amendments require federal prosecutors before entering a binding plea agreement to disclose impeachment information about informants or other witnesses. We hold the Constitution does not require that disclosure. They later say the Constitution does not require pre-guilty plea disclosure of impeachment evidence. Now, granted, they talked about impeachment there because that was the issue in that case. That's what was being waived. But we know from prior United States Supreme Court cases that the court treats both impeachment and exculpatory material evidence as equivalent for constitutional purposes. So we believe that the Ruiz decision should cover both, and it would be incredibly confusing, I think, for the court to try to split those two and say, well, there's a right to one but not the other in the guilty plea context. The reasoning of Ruiz also supports that reading because they said, as I just argued, that it doesn't go to the voluntariness of the plea because a defendant can plead knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily even though he has a misapprehension or a miscalculation. For example, he thinks a confession or he thinks the court is going to let in other crimes evidence. And if the court lets in other crimes evidence, he thinks he's hosed. There's no way he's going to get not convicted by the jury. And so he says, I'm going to take this deal. They're going to cut one offense and recommend a certain sentence. Even though he's wrong on that, even though his counsel's wrong in recommending that, wrong but not ineffective, that doesn't vitiate the voluntariness or knowingness of the plea. And that's because the Constitution doesn't require the defendant to know the strength of the respective party's cases. Both sides go into a plea bargain not knowing things the other side knows. Sure, the state has information the defendant may not have if it hasn't been disclosed in discovery, or the prosecutor, as in this case, chooses not to disclose it because she doesn't think she's required to. The defendant, if he's guilty, he knows a lot more than the state does about what really happened there, particularly in a situation where you have no other witnesses to testify.
Well, what about the argument that the U.S. Supreme Court in Ruiz was merely trying to save the whole fast-track process, that's really what they were looking at, and they weren't looking at the kind of situation we have here with Harris?
Well, that certainly was the fact situation in Ruiz. There's no question about that. That's what was before them in fact. But they're holding their language about the Constitution does not require pre-guilty plea disclosure was not limited to the fast-track situation, nor were the concerns about the fast track is something we just don't have here, so it's an odd concept to me anyway. But apparently the defendant very early on, because if he's offered this deal, he waives indictment as well as trial and appeal and disclosure of impeachment evidence specifically. Now, in Wisconsin, a plea agreement can come about at any point in time. I mean, sometimes plea agreements are entered into fairly early, particularly if you have multiple defendants. You have drive-by shooting, five people were in the car, one had the gun, others start giving you information. It may be that the person that the prosecutor feels is least culpable and most willing to tell what really happened will get a good deal on the front end.
But, counsel, isn't this case a little bit different because there was a discovery request made, and although the assistant ADA who was in charge initially didn't think it should have been provided, the supervisor did, and that's how come it was turned over after the plea. In other words, it was my understanding from the record, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the supervisor believed the information should have been turned over according to defense counsel's request for information. So it's a little different than if you have a very early plea and someone pleads shortly after they're charged, isn't it?
Well, let me just first, to the facts, say we know that when what the prosecutor said, the ADA who handled the case, was when she first got the report, she didn't turn it over because she didn't think it was exculpatory. She wanted more investigation. She wanted the police to talk to the grandfather. She set it aside. She forgot about it. She apparently rediscovered it after sentencing, and that's when she talked to the district attorney, who told her she should call defense counsel and tell her. We don't know, because there is no explanation in the record, why the prosecutor did that, whether that was his own policy that we turn over everything regardless, or whether he actually made a determination that she ought to have turned it over earlier. So that's the only part I would disagree, is that he didn't say you have to turn it over because he requested it, or you have to turn it over because it's material and exculpatory. To the constitutional question, the request by the defense doesn't matter at all, because the United States Supreme Court, although early on in the Brady and then a few subsequent cases, they had drawn lines between general requests, no requests, specific requests. Now it's all treated the same. So this case, for constitutional purposes, it doesn't make any difference if he had made no request at all, or if he had said, tell me if the child has made any prior allegations against anybody else, or just a general discovery request. Now, for statutory purposes, he did, apparently in his form motion, although it's not in the record, make a request for any exculpatory evidence under 973.21.1H, and we say that means only what the Constitution requires. He also apparently, I gather from the way the Court of Appeals talks, although as I say it's not in the record, he made a request for any type of information that could lead to further discovery or further investigation by the defense or something like that. If he was not entitled to that under either the statute, as we say, or the Constitution, then he's not entitled to it just because he requested it. And that court made this clear recently in State versus DeLeo, which is cited in our reply brief, where the court said, just because the defendant requests more than he's entitled to by statute or Constitution doesn't mean that he gets it.
Counsel, I want to focus on the statutory claim here. One of my concerns is your argument that the state does not have to give this information if there is a plea.
Right.
And that pertains to the statutory argument as well as the constitutional argument. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
You indicated earlier in your comments that sometimes pleas are early on in the proceedings, and I grant you that. My experience as a circuit court judge, however, indicates that the overwhelming majority are within 2 weeks before trial is to be scheduled. That may be wrong, but that's my experience. And indeed, some are 2 days before the trial is to be scheduled and would cause judges to have white and gray hair as a result of that late settlement. So here, let's say the case was going to trial. And as I understand it, a demand was made for this information or for information on May 30th. June 6th, status conference, this case is going to trial. All systems were go. July 11th, this case was going to trial. All systems were go. In fact, the defendant entered a plea, changed the plea of not guilty by reason of mental defect and disease on July 11th. Finally, within 2 weeks of trial, right within it, I think it was maybe the 25th of July or something, trial was scheduled to begin on August 6th, plea is made. When, under your interpretation, when is it, given that pleas often don't happen until within 2 weeks or 2 days of trial, when is it that the state was supposed to turn this information over?
I can't give you a date or a number of days before trial because the statute simply says within a reasonable time before trial. And what is a reasonable time before trial?
2 weeks.
Some judges will set discovery dates for both sides, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, prior to trial. And then, of course, the parties obviously have to obey that specific order. I don't know of any case in Wisconsin that has articulated what a reasonable time is. Now, here, obviously, in a sense, since there was no trial, it's hard to, how can you measure a reasonable time prior to trial? I think, however, if we look for guidance to the Constitution, which, is in that sense may be different than the statute, The constitutional cases also don't tell us when you have to disclose. The Brady line of cases, and by that I mean Brady, Augers, Bagley, Kyles versus Whitley, Strickley versus Green, all came up when the evidence was discovered after trial. So there never was an issue about, well, yeah, we got it, but we got it too late. There's a line of lower federal cases that says the test is whether he got it in time to use it effectively at trial. And interestingly, in the federal system, if I'm correctly understanding the discovery rules, the statutory rules in the federal system, you don't have to disclose witnesses before trial, except in capital cases 3 days before trial, and you don't have to disclose inconsistent witness statements until the witness has actually testified. Now, in Wisconsin, by statute, we have broader rules, but that I only say that to emphasize that getting it 2 weeks before trial or 3 days before trial isn't necessarily not getting it, it's not necessarily unreasonable.
Ms. Wellman, it's my understanding that there are some district attorneys in the state that just open the files to the defendant.
That's my understanding also.
And my question to you is this. So if you are charged, and I believe Milwaukee County opens it up.
That's my understanding.
Okay. If you're charged in Milwaukee County, the DA's practice is to the defendant, you can see whatever we got. And, of course, the defense need not tell the prosecuting attorney anything because there's a constitutional protection of self-incrimination and a constitutional requirement that it be beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay. But if you're charged in Waukesha County, a neighboring county, you may or may not get the benefit of all of the information, or in this particular county, which is not too far from Milwaukee, you don't get it. It's also my understanding that the general concept is that prosecutors are not there to rack up convictions, that they are there to do justice, which means ability to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Why shouldn't the policy be the same across the state? I'm not talking constitution. I'm not talking statute. But why, in a state with the same laws, shouldn't this be a policy? And why isn't it a good policy that the state tell the prosecutor, the defense, whatever they have?
I have to admit, I have not thought about that question. I guess it seems to me that it's not, it should not be required statewide, because if we're going to require, and this is not a very satisfactory answer off the top of my head, I don't think, but if we're going to require that, then it seems to me we have to require our prosecutors to do a lot of things the same in terms of charging, in terms of do you ever enter into a plea agreement like there was in this case where you say nothing at sentencing? Do you ever enter recommendations, you know, where you recommend a specific sentence? I mean, some prosecutors don't take Alford pleas or no contest pleas in sexual assault cases, particularly child sexual assault cases, because they say, no, you have to admit responsibility. That's the starting point. Nothing good is going to happen in terms of treatment if you don't do that. Other prosecutors say, no, we'd rather spare the child the trauma of trial regardless. I just don't think that we're, and I use we collectively for everyone, as a system, I don't think we're wise enough to make binding policies across the state.
But this goes to the whole integrity of the fact-finding process. It goes to the whole integrity of the plea. It goes to the whole integrity of the fact-finding process. Now, I don't know whether or not a jury would or would not have been persuaded. It's hard to shake a child, as you very well know, on the stand. But it does give you pause, at a minimum, pause. So I agree, and I would not want to make it uniform, make a whole lot of things uniform, because we have prosecutors under the Constitution. They have broad discretion in our law, from case to case, which it can vary. But this goes to the integrity of the system.
And very briefly, my response, it doesn't go to the, we don't believe it goes to the integrity of the system because the plea is still knowing, voluntary, intelligent within the definition that the Constitution requires, and that the only time when it should really be a critical factor is when you have an innocent defendant, that the exculpatory evidence actually exonerates as opposed to just creating a reasonable doubt. And the reason is that in the trial situation and other situations, the best we can do is look at, is there a reasonable probability of a different result? We can't know, is he guilty or not guilty? In the guilty plea situation, he's told us he's guilty. We're entitled to rely on that unless it completely exonerates him, which is a separate due process.
And you
right.
know, people plead guilty for any number of reasons. Get a better deal. You've got a man here who has, maybe the state doesn't agree with this, at least some difficulties of understanding. Originally went in as the, as Justice Bradley said, not guilty by a reason of mental disease or defect, lower than average IQ difficulties. Maybe any number of reasons why he pleads guilty, or in any particular situation. Of course, not for sentence. This man got 30 years, was it?
Plus the imprisonment
15.
Plus
15. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask?
Oh, sure.
Ms. Wellman, you were counsel for the state in the
Sturgeon. Yes.
Sturgeon case. There wasn't a petition for review in that case, was there?
No, there wasn't.
Why?
Well, the Sturgeon test itself, we did not disagree with at that time because all we had to go by were cases in other jurisdictions and lower federal courts, most of which, not all, but most of which had taken this approach of, yes, there is a right to it, and we measure it by whether there's a reasonable probability that he would have entered a plea anyway. So we had not made an argument there that there is no constitutional right to exculpatory material evidence prior to a guilty plea. We'd not seen that in any of the cases, and we didn't make it. It wasn't until after Ruiz that caused us to think perhaps that basic underpinning of Sturgeon is incorrect. As to the facts of Sturgeon itself, we thought it was close enough that although we don't agree with the result, we didn't think it was worthy of a petition for review. Does that answer your question?
You think we're bound by the Sturgeon case? I mean, is it precedential for us? We'd have to overturn
it. You would have to overrule it, and I think if you agree with us that Ruiz undercuts all the underpinnings of Sturgeon, then I think that is certainly good enough reason to depart from stare decisis.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is it Cook? Stephen A. Cook, representing the defendant, respondent Kevin Harris. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Stephen A. Cook. I'm an attorney from Elkhorn, Wisconsin, and I represent Kevin Harris, who is a mentally ill 31-year-old man with a ninth-grade education. I believe in the record is the psychological evaluation that was done of Mr. Harris, which indicates he has a chronic mental disorder with cognitive limitations in reasoning, judgment, and problem-solving. He also has significant difficulties with concentration, learning disabilities, and mood lability that impact his ability to complete any standardized assessment of intellectual, psychological, or emotional functioning. Mr. Harris has a history of suicide attempts, suffered from auditory hallucinations, and had 16 psychiatric hospitalizations over a 20-year period. We're here today to review the Court of Appeals decision, which upheld the decision of the trial court, in which the trial court exercises discretion in granting Mr. Harris's motion to withdraw his guilty plea based upon the fact that the state had failed to turn over evidence that the child who had accused Mr. Harris of assaulting her had previously been sexually assaulted by her grandfather. Now, what happened here is Mr. Harris entered a guilty plea to a charge of first-degree sexual assault of a child with the repeater provision, which had an exposure of 70 years of prison. He received a 45-year sentence, which was 30 years initial confinement and 15 years of extended supervision, which for a man of Mr. Harris's age is essentially a life sentence. After Mr. Harris entered his plea, the assistant district attorney who was handling the case contacted Mr. Harris's trial counsel. The record shows she was upset at the time she contacted Mr. Harris's trial counsel and advised Mr. Harris's trial counsel that she had not disclosed evidence that the child had previously been sexually assaulted. This was done at the direction of the district attorney for Walworth County. And after she had discussed this with the district attorney for Walworth County, the alleged sexual assault perpetrated on the child by her grandfather occurred approximately 2 months prior to the assault allegedly perpetrated by Mr. Harris, but it wasn't disclosed until approximately 2 months after Mr. Harris's assault. And what we have here is the assault allegedly occurs in February of 2001. Mr. Harris's alleged assault occurs in April of 2001. The child, shortly after Mr. Harris's assault, discloses that assault, but then doesn't disclose the assault allegedly perpetrated by the grandfather until June of 2001, approximately June 12th of 2001. This is after Mr. Harris's trial counsel had filed the discovery demand on his behalf. And it comes approximately 1 month prior to the state providing to the court and trial counsel a notice of expert witness disclosure that the state is going to call as an expert witness a social worker, one of two of them, who will testify about the reactive behaviors of a child to being sexually assaulted. And it's a very broad disclosure that the state makes. And the state makes this disclosure after they received the notice that this child had allegedly been assaulted by her grandfather. Now, in the discovery demand, Mr. Harris's trial counsel specifically requested all exculpatory evidence, and he also requested all evidence that could lead to the discovery of exculpatory evidence. The discovery demand is very broad. I understand, unfortunately, it's not part of the record, but it's an extensive, extensive discovery demand of approximately 20 paragraphs.
Was the defendant entitled to all of that discovery?
I believe under the statute he was entitled to all of that discovery. If the court reads the discovery statute, specifically 971.3, there is an extensive litany of items that the state is to disclose. And it is approximately 9 paragraphs long, including any relevant written or recorded statements of a witness named on a list, on a witness list. Now, we're here because the state claims that Ruiz, United States versus Ruiz, overrules the Court of Appeals decision in State versus Sturgeon. The Court of Appeals in this case specifically distinguished Ruiz by finding several things. One, the constitutional question presented to the U.S. Supreme Court arose out of a factual situation which involved 30 kilograms of marijuana being found in Angela Ruiz's luggage in the Southern District of California. Ms. Ruiz was offered what they call there a fast-track plea agreement. A fast-track plea agreement involves the defendant waiving his or her right to indictment, trial, and appeal in exchange for a two-level downward departure under the federal sentencing guidelines. In addition,
Mr. Cook, let me, if I might, ask you, I know you're claiming both a constitutional violation and a statutory violation. Which are, from your point of view, which is the stronger argument? Do you feel that you've got a very strong argument on the statute, or do you think Ruiz and Sturgeon are what controls here?
Well, I think the stronger argument is under the statute.
Why?
I think the stronger argument is under the statute because of the language in the statute, which states that what a district attorney must disclose to a defendant, that's the heading of 971.23 sub 1, and it states, upon demand, the district attorney shall, within a reasonable time before trial, disclose to the defendant or his or her attorney and permit the defendant or his or her attorney to inspect and and copy or photograph all of the following materials and information.
How would you define that reasonable time before trial?
I would define reasonable time before trial at least 2 weeks prior to trial. With this type of information, in which we're dealing with a situation where the defense would have to do further investigation, we have an out-of-state, potential out-of-state witness, which is a grandfather. He's in Texas. We would have to pursue attempting to get a material witness warrant and bring him back to testify at a Pulizzano hearing. The other reason I would state that is so that the trial court could have an orderly hearing of this case, and so that the trial court could hear a Pulizzano motion before the jury comes in, is seated, and the evidence is dropped on the defendant's desk. With providing the defendant this information approximately 2 weeks to 30 days before trial, they can do their investigation. They can attempt to speak to the principals involved. They can file a motion. They can get the witnesses there, and the motion can be heard. And then everybody knows what's going to happen at trial.
Was the plea in this case entered within that 2 weeks to 30 days period?
It was entered approximately 13 days before trial, approximately.
Well, it really sounds as if the standard is not 2 weeks, but enough time for the defendant to use the information and investigate it and process it. So if it was something that was more esoteric, it might take 4 weeks. If it's something that would be a simple thing to check, it might take 5 days.
Correct, Matt. Correct. And what I was thinking of in this case, the statute talks about a reasonable time. This is not something that you can just automatically supply to a defense counsel. I know in the county that this case was heard in, the state frequently moves that the defense provide their discovery 30 days before trial. That's the standard motion that the Walworth County District Attorney's Office files in every criminal case that is commenced in Walworth County.
Counsel, is there any legislative history that supports an interpretation or advances an interpretation of what is meant by reasonable time?
Not that I was able to find.
I thought in your brief you made reference to the California statute here. Was that, and the Court of Appeals discussed the legislative history of the California statute?
Yes, it discussed the legislative history of a similar provision in the Wisconsin statute, and I believe that was in the case of State versus Revels, in which they talked about the defense's obligation to disclose, and it talks about a legislative reference bureau drafting note to the bill that eventually became 971.232M, indicates it was patterned after the California statute. The Court of Appeals in that case noted that the language of the Wisconsin statute tracks the California law almost verbatim, and the preamble talks about that the purpose of it is to promote the ascertainment of truth in trial by requiring timely pretrial discovery and to save court time in trial and avoid the necessity for frequent interruptions.
Counselor, we've been asking you about reasonable time under the statute, and I guess my question to you is, it's a reasonable time before trial, but does that same standard govern for pleas? In other words, if you're talking to the district attorney about a plea for your client, and they have information that you have requested that perhaps, you know, the discovery request just hasn't been fulfilled, are you asking us to take the position that there has to be a disclosure of that before the plea, even if the plea would come a month before trial or 6 weeks before trial?
Well, I think that a defendant is entitled to know the nature of the charges against him and to know the nature of the allegations. And I think that disclosure has to occur prior to a plea occurring. And what I think this Court has to find that this Court has to find there needs to be disclosed, depending on the nature of the evidence, a reasonable time before trial. And that's what the legislature has set forth.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, do you give up any protections under the statute when you enter a plea? You said you thought your strongest argument was under the statute, and I can understand that, and then we've all been focusing on reasonable time, but it's reasonable time before trial, and I'm just wondering what your position on this is. Do you give up some of those statutory protections involved in a reasonable time if you plea, because the plea can come any time.
That's correct. I don't believe you give up those protections.
Do you think once a discovery request is made, we should conclude that it has to be given to you before you plea? So if you say, yeah, we're going to enter a plea, then it's that at that point, if discovery has not been fully provided to defense counsel, that the DA must then give whatever would have been given, quote, a reasonable time before trial if the matter had proceeded?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
And then also, otherwise, the defendant would have an argument for ineffective assistance of counsel because his counsel did not pursue the necessary discovery for him to make a knowing and voluntary plea.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
So this can be a really very narrow case, as I understand your position. Your position is if there's a discovery request, then the state has to give what information? What kind of information? How would you describe it?
Well, I would...
The exculpatory, impeachment, leading to other evidence, evidence to be investigated. What language would you use?
The language that I would use is the language as contained in the discovery statute itself, which states any exculpatory evidence, which talks about criminal records of witnesses, which is impeachment evidence. Otherwise, why would that have to be disclosed? Any physical evidence that the district attorney intends to offer in evidence at the trial, any relevant written or recorded statements of a witness named on a witness list.
Okay, where does the information in this case come in those categories?
Where I see it coming in is under subsection H, any exculpatory evidence, and also under any relevant written or recorded statements of a witness. The statute doesn't talk about admissibility. It talks about discovery, and it talks about relevant written or recorded statements of witnesses, and it talks about any exculpatory evidence. It doesn't say any admissible evidence. It talks broadly.
What's the recorded statement here? What is the recorded statement? Yeah.
That was not turned over?
Yeah.
The statement that was not turned over was the fact that the child had been sexually assaulted.
I know, but who said that?
The child.
Child told the DA's office or somebody connected with the DA's office.
A detective from the city of Alcorn.
That she had been assaulted by her grandfather.
Yes.
Before this assault came.
Yes. And there is an extent.
So it's the detective's recorded statement.
Yes. And there is an extensive recorded statement. By extensive, I mean 6, 7, 8 pages, which I had attached to my amended motion to reopen, or strike that, amended motion to set aside Mr. Harris's plea. The child gave details as to when the assault occurred, where it occurred, who else was in the room with her, how it occurred. It was a very detailed statement.
Counsel, I just want to go back to Justice Crooks's question. If you have to choose between the Constitution and 971-23, you said, well, you think the stronger is on 971-23, and I know there was extensive argument in the briefs on that, but the state is taking the position, as I understand it, that 971-23 basically couldn't require any more than the Constitution, the Ruiz case. And there was another question from on that end of the bench as far as the legislative history. And you would be saying that the statute is really broader. I mean, is that your argument?
Yes.
And the legislative history does it point that out? I think there's a real argument as far as what the history shows, and that the department is arguing, at least that their understanding is that it did not increase or was made broader than what was called for under Brady or Ruiz. And it should not be read to do that as far as this exculpatory evidence is concerned. What's your response to that? Where do you get that?
Well, my response is twofold. One is the plain language of the statute. If the legislature wanted it to merely codify Brady, it could have said any material exculpatory evidence. It could have said any exculpatory evidence that is required to be disclosed under Brady versus Maryland. It didn't say that. Secondly, the legislative history talks about This bill expands the discovery and disclosure requirements that apply to both the prosecutor and the defendant by doing all of the following. And then it does go on and state, the bill codifies a requirement established in case law that a prosecutor must disclose and allow inspection and copying of any evidence that is favorable to the defendant. Also, one of the documents that the state also attached, the last document, which is a fiscal estimate from the Director of State Courts, states this bill expands the discovery and disclosure requirements that apply to both the prosecutor and the defendant. So we're talking about an expansion of the requirements of the state to turn over evidence from the previous bill. Also, this court and also the Court of Appeals has ruled in a series of cases, Delau, Del Rio, and Gribble, as well as Rebels, that we're moving towards more discovery. We're moving towards a more expansive view of discovery in criminal cases. And in each one of those cases, I believe the courts of this state have ruled more expansively for more discovery for both sides.
What about the kind of impeachment evidence that was in Ruiz? Would that be required to be disclosed under the statute?
I believe so. I think it does. And that's because of the language that's contained in the statute, which talks about any relevant written or recorded statements of a witness named on a witness list. That talks about a criminal record of a prosecution witness. Certainly that's impeachment evidence.
What about the arguments that Justice Breyer made in the Ruiz case about really undermining the government's witnesses and destroying the incentive for plea bargains?
And what Justice Breyer was talking about was a specific reference to the federal system and to the specific facts of the case that arose from the federal fast-track plea agreement. When Justice Breyer is writing these things, he also cites certain rules of discovery that are in the federal system, which are much more restrictive than what we have here in the state of Wisconsin. And he specifically cites 18 U.S. Code 3432, which states witness list disclosure required in capital cases 3 days before trial with exceptions. Section 3500, government witness statements ordinarily subject to discovery only after testimony.
But I'd like you to address the policy of disclosing informants and witnesses that the state might want to keep confidential, and the state is willing to give substantial plea bargains to keep that information confidential. You're basically saying they can't do that.
Well, but what they can do under the statute, there are two safe harbors for the state under our statute here in the state of Wisconsin. One is 971.23 sub 6, which provides that the state can apply to the trial court for a protective order, stating, hey, judge, we shouldn't have to turn this over for these reasons. Secondly, under 971.236M, they can apply for an in-camera review to the trial court, for the trial court to review it and mask any evidence that they're asking should not be disclosed to the defense. So there are safe havens, safe harbors built into our statute here in the state of Wisconsin that are not, as far as I understand federal law, are not built into the federal procedures. I think our statute has gone far beyond what is embodied in the federal statutes, and that it has also provided safe havens for the state. In this case, if the state didn't think this evidence was materially exculpatory or was exculpatory, they could have applied to the court. And they could have asked for their own Polizano hearing as a motion in limine and said, Judge Carlson or Judge Gibbs, I don't think this evidence should come in. I don't think it fits under Polizano. I want this court to make a pretrial ruling that this evidence should not come in during the trial of this matter. The state didn't do it. And by the assistant district attorney's own statements, initially she looked at it, didn't think it should be turned over, and then she forgot about it. That's what she stated.
You have to meet the Hatcher standards to get this plea withdrawn, don't you?
Well, I think there's two standards that I would have to meet. The first would be under Hatcher and Sturgeon, but also the trial court, although it didn't specifically state this, could find there was a manifest injustice within when Ms. that there was a manifest injustice which would allow Mr. Harris to withdraw his plea in this matter. And that's the standard for other than a constitutional violation. We had initially brought the motion under Sturgeon and Hatcher, which states a person has a right, absolute right, to withdraw their plea when there's been a constitutional violation. But it could also be interpreted that there was a manifest injustice here which should allow Mr. Harris to withdraw his plea. And this court reviews that under the erroneous exercise of discretion standard. And the trial court is the one who sat through the hearing, observed Mr. Harris, observed the demeanor of the lawyers as they spoke, and made its ruling.
Given the fact that the defendant, as I understand the facts, told the police one story about his contact with the little girl, and then spontaneously called and said otherwise, and said the little girl was in my apartment, and I touched her head, and I touched her leg. I didn't touch her anywhere else. I mean, why would the little girl have been in his apartment if they didn't know each other? I mean, how were you going to take the evidence with respect to the alleged assault by the grandfather and turn that into some sort of innocence on the part of the defendant?
Well, it's noted that Mr. Harris did not state that he sexually assaulted the little girl. There is not a confession or an admission that he actually did sexually assault the child. What also
not even in the plea agreement? The plea colloquy?
For sure. Yes, there is. In the plea colloquy, there is a guilty plea. But this court, I didn't understand your question then. I thought you were asking me at a trial. And the guilty, if there is a subsequent trial, the admission of guilt in a plea colloquy would not be admissible in the trial. He did not specifically admit at the time he spoke to the detective that he did sexually assault the child. What also we have here, and I'm here to tell this court that I didn't deal with issues of admissibility at the hearing. We did not have a Polizano motion before the court. The court did not rule that this evidence would be admissible at the subsequent trial. And the reason for that is because the trial court said it appears the state was backfilling. We didn't turn it over so that we didn't have to turn it over. Then you didn't have a Polizano hearing, and now we're saying it didn't have to be turned over. That's how the trial court approached it. How I would approach it is I would file a Polizano motion. I would attempt to speak with the grandfather. I would bring the grandfather back, and we would have a pretrial ruling as to whether or not this evidence would come in, so that if we're at the actual hearing, at the actual trial, we would have a pretrial ruling as to whether this evidence could come in. Also, I think it's very important evidence because when the state disclosed its expert, the defense didn't know that this evidence existed. So the defense couldn't effectively cross-examine the state's expert as to the fact that this child exhibited characteristics of someone who had been sexually assaulted. The defense attorney also hadn't hired its own expert to attempt to rebut the state's expert in this case, which is how I personally would approach the case, is to get my own expert in this case. If that's the court's question. Getting back to the Ruiz case, I think Ruiz focuses primarily upon the federal system, as it also talks about what was offered to Ms. Ruiz in exchange for her plea here. This federal government offered her that it would turn over any evidence which would prove her factual innocence and would continue to turn over that evidence. The U.S. Supreme Court also talked about Federal Criminal Procedure Rule Number 11, which is an extensive rule detailing what needs to occur and what has to happen when it's taking a plea from a criminal defendant, something that is not present in the state of Wisconsin. In addition, I think Ruiz is distinguishable. I think the United States Supreme Court was attempting to do its best to uphold the federal fast-track plea agreement process in the Southern District of California, as the Wisconsin Court of Appeals found. Because we also have to look at Ruiz in that Ms. Ruiz didn't take the federal fast-track plea agreement. So ultimately, I think we can presume, although it doesn't state in the case, that she received the information, the impeachment information, because she couldn't point specifically to something that should have been turned over to her. Whereas we can do that in this case. We can point to this court and say, this should have been turned over. I'm not dealing with something that may be out there or that may possibly exist. It does exist, and it clearly wasn't turned over. I also think that we can look at the fact that we filed a Brady demand. Mr. Harris filed a Brady demand. He filed a demand under the statutes. Ruiz did not do so in any way, shape, or form. The concerns of the United States Supreme Court detailing the concerns that are listed by the federal government are also reflected in the congressional history, as it states that the Criminal Justice of the House Committee, apparently pursuant to the statement of an acting assistant attorney general, opposed mandated witness disclosures 3 days before a trial because of documented instances of witness intimidation. There's nothing to that effect presented here in the legislative history from the state of Wisconsin. That was present, however, in the federal legislative history that was presented to the United States Supreme Court. The court also seemed to focus on, does a federal criminal defendant have this right? And the court used that specific language. And we have to presume that the court used that language for a reason, because it was specifically addressing the federal criminal defendant's rights under the federal statute and also under the federal fast-track plea agreement. It did not state all criminal defendants. And therefore, I think Sturgeon is still good law, and I think this court should also uphold and find that Sturgeon is good law and uphold the decision of the trial court and the decision of the Court of Appeals in granting Mr. Harris's motion to set aside his guilty plea. Finally, once again with regards to Ruiz, we look at also at the court stated when it was talking about the rights that Ms. Ruiz waived to receive information the government has regarding any affirmative defense. They talked about in the context of this agreement, and I'm at headnote number 9, and it talks about, we do not believe the Constitution here requires provision of this information to the defendant prior to plea bargaining for most, though not all, of the reasons previously stated. That is to say, in the context of this agreement, the need for this information is more closely related to the fairness of a trial than to the voluntariness of a plea. They didn't talk broadly when they made that decision. They talked about the context within the federal fast-track plea agreement. I'm asking this court to uphold the decisions of the trial court and the decisions of the District 2 Court of Appeals in granting Mr. Harris's motion to withdraw his guilty plea.
Could I ask, a plea was entered on July 25th, 2001. How long had plea negotiations been underway?
I was in trial counsel. I can't answer that question. I don't know how long plea negotiations had been underway. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wellman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Let me just address the statutory construction issue briefly, because I didn't really get into that. Obviously, the statute broadened the law because it created, the entire statute, the bill created a system of reciprocal discovery, which previously hadn't existed. There was no right for the prosecutor to ask the defendant for information. So that statement, and the statement in the case, is actually that some of the provisions were broadened, not all. So we don't think that that alone is enough to construe the phrase any exculpatory evidence to mean, when the LRB analysis says codify the case law, to mean broader than the case law. If it doesn't codify the case law, then what does it mean? I think the Court of Appeals, frankly, just looked at the word any, took that to mean all or every, and said, well, that's broader. But what does exculpatory mean? If we don't have the case law that tells us exculpatory includes impeachment, then arguably the statute doesn't include impeachment.
Well, counsel, don't we have case law that says exculpatory includes impeachment?
But it's interpreted because it's interpreting the constitutional provision. not stand alone the statute.
Let me take a look at this legislative history, and you're correct. The legislative history, the LRB, in terms of the analysis for changes of the made by the bill, indicates the bill expands the discovery and disclosure requirements that apply to both the prosecutor and the defendant, and that's the first thing in terms of changes made by the bill. However, the fifth thing says the bill codifies the requirements established in the law that a prosecutor must disclose and allow inspection and copying of any evidence that is favorable to the defendant. How do you get around that legislative history?
Well, I think that's a slight overstatement of what the law actually, what the case law he's trying to describe actually does, because he doesn't use the terms of art, material, and exculpatory.
He doesn't. There's no reference to in any of this legislative history to Brady, as you're advancing. It's supposedly based on Brady. Is that
right,
correct?
Right, and his progeny. Right.
In fact, quite the contrary. There's legislative history that specifically says that the preliminary draft is based on the state of California discovery law, which is contained in reference to California statutes. And so that's what it looks like this law is based on. Is that correct?
Well, both are true. I think it's based on the California law because California had a reciprocal discovery law. But California uses the same phrase, and I could not find any case law that discusses whether that is broader or consistent with the Constitution. We also, I know we did not adopt all of the California provisions, although off the top of my head, I can't remember which ones we did not adopt.
I didn't look at this carefully, but as your opposing counsel noted, the Court of Appeals in State versus Revels indicated with regard to this California statute, that is the foundation for our law, 971-23-1H, that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals discussed the statute in Revel and said that the legislative intent of the California statute is to promote the ascertainment of truth in trial by requiring timely pretrial discovery and to save court time in trial and avoid the necessity for frequent interruptions. So I don't know if they're correct, but at least that's what our 1998 Court of Appeals said.
Right, and we believe that interpreting the phrase any exculpatory evidence to mean anything that the case law says the Constitution requires to be disclosed will fulfill those policies.
Counselor, why doesn't this statement fall under 971-23-1E as a recorded statement of a witness?
Because standing alone, knowing nothing more than the fact that she says that she was also assaulted by someone else, is not relevant.
Well, it is when the state names someone who's going to talk about this child exhibits characteristics of someone who's been sexually assaulted, then the question becomes, well, by whom? I mean, maybe she exhibits these characteristics because of what the grandfather did, or maybe because of what the defendant is alleged to have done.
It could become relevant at trial, but standing alone without having had an expert testifying, we don't know that the expert would have said that. Standing alone, the fact that someone has been sexually assaulted at two points in time by two different people doesn't make it more or less probable that one or the other assaulted her.
That may be true, but this is a discovery statute. It is not an admissibility of evidence statute, and discovery comes generally before trial. And at least according to this statute, you must interpret relevant in regard to the time frame in which the statute's to operate, correct?
And the time frame is only that the state may or may not introduce that expert, but they have not done it yet. I don't think.
I mean, when you have a grandfather that's out of state, how in the world is the defendant ever to make use of this if you're going to wait until the evidence the state presents at trial, then we're going to take a break in the trial, and now the evidence becomes relevant, and now we have to go and look at all of this? It doesn't seem to me to fit within with what discovery is supposed to provide. I mean, you're telling me that this evidence just simply isn't relevant until we're at trial then, right?
Well, I'm saying standing alone, it's not relevant. It could become relevant depending on what else happened at trial or developed or whether the state, in fact, used that expert witness. And my understanding is that the state files this notice of expert witness in cases, and it doesn't necessarily always then call those experts.
I know, but when we look at how relevance is interpreted in discovery statutes, it's different than how relevance is interpreted when you're trying to admit evidence Would you agree with that premise?
I guess I'm not understanding how relevance means something different in the discovery statute than...
I don't think that, I mean, the statute does say relevance. So the only reason you think you didn't have to have it provided here is because of that word. Obviously, it's a statement of a witness, right?
Correct.
Okay. So we're focusing on relevance, but we're not focusing relevance on a statute that allows or prohibits admissibility of evidence at trial. We're talking about relevance as it relates to someone trying to prepare their defense in a case, correct?
Correct.
So the relevance here is on counsel's ability to evaluate the defense, to advise the defendant of the strength of the state's case and the strength of his own case, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So if those are our parameters, I have a hard time seeing why it's not relevant.
We're relying on the case law that we cite in our brief that the fact that someone has been assaulted by someone else doesn't make it more or less probable that the other assault didn't occur.
But that's not the question to which it may be relevant.
It may be
relevant to someone else's testimony that's going to come on at trial, correct?
To impeach them.
It's possible it could be relevant to the expert's testimony.
Right.
It's possible that it would also cause the district attorney to not offer that expert witness because she now has different information than, she had at the beginning.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Ms. Wellman. Thank you, Mr. Cook, for your arguments on State v. Kevin Harris, a case that presents an issue the Court hasn't dealt with recently. So we appreciate your informative briefs and your informative arguments. That concludes our hearing on 02-2433-CR, State v. Harris. We'll take a couple of moments of recess so that the students may leave, and then we'll call our next case.